Lots of shining faces. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
What a delight and privilege it is to be with all of you, beautiful, shining hearts and faces. I want to start by reading an account by a writer who is a Zen teacher and also a psychoanalyst, Paul Cooper, who wrote an account of one of his experiences in a retreat just about like this. Some of this may sound a little familiar. I feel the bubbling over. Watch the volcanic eruption. Watch self. Watch selves. Others. Form. Melt. Crystallize. Shatter. In permutations of liquid psychic lava. Emotional upsurge and outflow. Zazen increases the capacity for handling geometrically increasing intensities. Continued sitting in the wider oscillations of whatever rises and falls as aspects of this one larger process brings into the present situation an awareness of inner obstructions and dissolves them. Dissolves, in this case, anger, which, when suffered, transforms into passion, evolves into awareness in the form of many thoughts and feelings, with variations in speed and intensity. Passion. Longing for union with the divine, with a lover, with the universe. Teachings, truth, life, death, moment, infinite moment, intimate contact with the depths of my own being. Passion of forms, images swirling, spewing multicolored mind flowers that blossom, then melt away to the limits of what I can take, and then back to breathing and sitting. A ringing bell, slowly up and walking once again. So I want to just really build on the talks given by my wonderful compatriots. I kind of feel like maybe I'm saying the same thing that's already been said, but you know, old wine and new bottles, so. So I really am taking up this phenomenon that Paul Cooper is describing here of how Zen practice helps us bear witness to and enlarge our capacity for transformation. Peter Hirschhoff, in his book, called the early koan masters masters of improvisational virtuosity. And I submit that we're all practicing this week transformational virtuosity. We're getting good at it. And so I'm just going to share some field notes on facets of dragon riding, some things that I have noticed in myself, in the koans, and in you all. And the first thing, you know, that I'll just say over and over about anything, is it really helps to start with what Joan would call a place of kindness and curiosity. That's the prerequisite, you know. Just be warm with yourself, kind with yourself, and with each other, and all that is arising in your heart and in the field. And curious, huh? You know, not in a head way, not in a like figuring it out way, right? But in the kind of embodied way, in the energetic way, huh? Like that. And in a way, I think we're talking about kind of maybe a double dragon. There's the primacy of experience in the present moment. And that's what we're showing up for in our practice. We're showing up for this moment, the experience of what it's like in this moment. And that can be turbulent, it can be joyful, it can be so many things. The heartbreak, you know, the joy, the confusion and stuckness, the leaping and diving. And there's also a kind of wise dragon that we're cultivating. The dragon that sees it all happening, you know, that's kind of maybe just a slight bit removed and can say, ah, I see the long view. I see that all of this is rising and falling. All of this transformation. This is the dragon that can see it all, can hold it all, can make use of it all. Maybe this is part of what Freud was talking about when he talked about evenly hovering attention. You know, seeing everything with a just and loving gaze, as Simone Weil called it, to have that big view. That's maybe we could call it the containing dragon, the dragon that forms the vessel, the sturdy vessel. And really, we're forming that vessel here with all of the forms of sesshin, of retreat, the roles that we play, the bells, that's all forming our sturdy vessel. And then, so that we can carry it all. And then the dragon of transformation, the one that's always flipping and changing and moving and rearing up and diving down, that's the dragon that we might call the contained. You know, the one that's doing the moving, the one that we honor and that enlarges us and that sometimes threatens to make us feel crazy. So I'm going to talk about sort of a few different facets of dragonology. I keep thinking, you know, when my son was little, his favorite book was called How to Train Your Dragon. So I keep thinking about that dragonology. It was easier in the book. So I first want to just talk about the dragon of the heart. You know, maybe these are the dragon murmurings that we're paying attention to. Sometimes it's a small voice at first that we have to tune into. You know, other things can be so loud. Our habits are loud. You know, our opinions are loud. Our conditioning, our minds. And so to really tune into the murmurings, the parts of the heart that take a while to subtle, to feel, to explore. There's a beautiful koan from the women's koan collection where somebody asked a teacher, what is Zen? And The teacher replied, "The heart of the one who asks is Zen." So, your heart, you know, whatever, in whatever condition it is, no exceptions, you know, that's it. And to really honor that dragon. So, how do we do that? We just do this kind of unusual thing, really, which is to let ourselves feel what we feel all the way through, completely, with no holds barred, in our body, in our sort of energy field, in our heart, in those old and creaky rooms, you know, maybe the basement, you know, all those places where it shows up. And we just face it. And we don't turn away. And that is hard to do. And we are training our hearts to be, to not avoid, to not turn away from difficulty, and that is a beautiful thing. And the first day or two or five or ten of a retreat like this, I think many of us start out, you know, in the dragon of the heart and all that's coming up, all that we've pushed away because our lives are so busy, all that we haven't had time for, all that's rearing up all of a sudden, or maybe not surprisingly. So we tend to that dragon with that kindness, you know, and curiosity. Listen to those dragon murmurings. I'm going to take a slight detour from talking about dragons to talk about snakes. Has anybody seen one? Has anybody seen a rattler? Yeah, not this. Yeah, okay. But we're all aware that they're around, right? They're in our minds. And you know, whereas, as Tenny mentioned the other night, dragons are often seen as benevolent. You know, they're protectors and agents of transformation, of time. Snakes can feel kind of dangerous, right? They're more of a trickster energy. And frankly, they're scary. You know, they surprise you. You don't know that they're there, and all of a sudden, you know? And people, I think, from all times and places have been scared of snakes. And sometimes even in our Buddhist tradition, they're sort of counterposed with dragons. So there's a koan that says where Wuzo asked Manjusri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, "How's Buddhism where you come from?" And Manjusri said, "The worldly and the holy are living together. Dragons and snakes are mingled." So we can see that, you know, I think dragons are the holy people, I think, and maybe snakes are the ordinary people. Or maybe it's the other way around. Or maybe they're all mingling in one thing, you know. One, two, who knows. But there is a feeling of that snake energy is something you better watch out for. It's on the margins, you know. So, you know, in this koan, that duality is healed between dragons and snakes, but we can also play with it. And I think it's really helpful sometimes to look at the snake energy. So one of the koans we've been looking at is Blue Cliff Record, case 22. Zhui Feng said to the assembly, "There's a turtle-nosed snake on South Mountain. All of you should go have a good look." Uh-oh. Chongqing said, "There are definitely people in this hall today who could lose their lives." Yunmen, the great teacher who's here, a student, you know, he threw his staff down in front of Zhui Feng and made a show of being afraid. Ah! So, apparently the snake, you know, it could kill you. A number of people here. And as Tenny said, this is an image of not just the small death, but the great death, you know. It's a process of stripping down, of letting go, simplifying, and it's painful. It can be painful. Sometimes it's joyous or relieving, but often it feels hard. We're letting go of identities, selves, stories about ourselves and the world, ways of being that may have been with us for a very long time. So things fall away, and energetic knots kind of get really tight, and then they can release. So this is the sort of gradual part of that snake energy, that dying, falling away energy, and it's a part of practice. And this can be hard, it can be scary, it can be painful, it can be confusing, and we think, this is not what I signed up for. I remember when I was practicing up at St. Dorothy's Rest in California, you know, walking outside on a break and just looking around me in the forest, and just everything was dying every moment. Die, die, die. And I could feel everything dying. I could feel myself dying. I could feel my loved ones dying. I could feel the earth dying. I could look at a tree or a flower and see it dying. And it's kind of shocking. It's hard to be in that place of the snake energy. It takes everything away from you. But it's the death, it's a necessary death. The death of versions of ourself that we're ready to shed like the skin of a snake. They don't fit us anymore. They constrict us. We let go. But if you've ever seen a snake shedding its skin, it doesn't look easy. And sometimes the snake energy is sudden. It's the phone call in the middle of the night. It's the trip to the emergency room. It's the moment when everything falls away. This is a phenomenon that the psychoanalyst Wilfred Bion called catastrophic change. Change that happens so quickly that it isn't easy to assimilate. Something turns completely over, falls completely away, and everything is forever different. And we're afraid of this. Sometimes it's linked to another psychoanalyst, Winnicott's idea of a fear of breakdown. A fear of catastrophic change, a fear of chaos, a fear of going crazy, of what will happen if I lose everything. It feels like we could just fall into bits or fall out of the universe, you know. And one thing that I love about this koan is that Yunmen actually takes up this part of the snake. He's afraid. You know, there's a playful aspect to it when he throws down the staff.
Ah.
But he's speaking to truth, that when we're faced with this snake energy, that it is something that we want to run away from. It's like an instinct. It's the great death that is a part of practice. And, you know, I've been thinking about it here, you know, with the in the Catholic community on Holy Week, that we've been really a part of another tradition that holds a great death. In the Bible, Luke 17:33, it says, "Whoever tries to keep his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it." And the Zen master Bankei said, "Die and then live. Day and night within the world. Once you've done this, then you can hold the world right in your hand." So this snake energy, the peeling away, luckily it's not the only part of the story. There's another koan also featuring Yunmen. And I think this is some years later. Yunmen held up his staff and said to the assembly, "This giraffe becomes a dragon. It has swallowed the whole universe. The mountains, rivers, and great earth, where do they come from?" So maybe this is a great birth, as Tenney said. It's sort of in a dynamic relationship with the great death. You know, like a yin-yang coming into being. And in this koan, Yunmen is embodying that great dragon energy. The swoosh of it, the power, the fecundity, the epic scale. I just have always loved this koan and how it just takes us on this incredible journey in just a few lines from an ordinary staff to a dragon to swallowing the whole universe. And then somehow mountains, rivers, and the great earth emerge. The staff, you know, is the teaching staff. And I'm so bummed I forgot mine. I just got my staff. I was going to have my moment with it. I left it in my room. So I'll have to just pantomime, as does Yunmen. But, you know, it's also a kind of a transformational object, this teaching staff. It's an ordinary thing. It's a, you know, a thing that we can rely on. It's an intimate thing. But it's also the site of transformation. It's where some magic can happen. I was noticing how many of our teaching sticks have scars on them. they've been transformed. They're not just pretty sticks, you know. They've had a moment of transformation themselves. And so when the staff becomes a dragon, it swallows the whole universe. So I want to pause there. The dragon has swallowed the whole universe. Right here. You know, I am in the milk and the milk's in me. And this evokes to me a moment of digestion. The psychoanalyst Bion talked about the importance of emotional digestion. And it's not just emotions like feelings, but just all of the sensory inputs, you know, that accumulate in us, and they need to be digested. They just kind of end up feeling like, after a while, like they're just bombarding you. You know that feeling when you get saturated? And it's just like bombardment. So what do we do with that? We need to find a way to digest. And in my version, that's what the dragon does. It swallows the whole universe, and it sits there for a while, you know, digesting. And that's another thing that we're doing here, you know, with our dragon riding, is we're just digesting experiences because we have the time and the space to do that. So something can process, and sometimes it's, we're not even aware of it. Sometimes it's not in words, it's not in ideas, it's not even in feeling, but it's just like something's happening like at a deeply subterranean level, you know? Something is in process, and all we can do is just trust that that's happening. We don't have to know much about it. And when that digestion at some point, you know, in that process, something starts to be born. And this is where the great birth has come back in. The emergence of mountains, rivers, and the great earth. New growth, creative, loving, and loosely woven. You know, those structures that we peeled away, that dropped away. Something comes back, but it feels looser. It doesn't have that constricting quality. And it's sort of provisional. Sort of like a, you know, a really loosely woven thing that can kind of shift. You know, it's not set. It's not tight. And I feel in this koan the energy of the Great Mother, of that just incredible hope and power. And another day, you know, in that retreat at St. Dorothy's Rest, I walked outside in the forest, and everything was born. Born, every moment, born, arising, creating, manifesting. Incredible, amazing. The same tree, the same flower. Born. Born. And this great dragon mother energy isn't just showy. You know, sometimes it's in this mode of digestion where you can't see anything happening. Sometimes it's in a mode of incubation. We're sitting with something that is just needs time. we just need to sit with it. Sometimes there's a feeling of a spiritual pregnancy. We can feel that something's taking form, coalescing. And, you know, I think about just those early weeks and months of my own pregnancy when you know that there's a being in there and you have no idea who it is, what this person will be, what this being will come to mean. You know nothing, but you just know something's forming. Something's very provisionally and very delicately coming into being. Sometimes this dragon mother energy is a moment of birth, which we all know can be painful and messy when something new is really coming forth. You know, it can feel pretty janky at first. It can feel like, what is this? How is this going to go? Am I going to be able to stand this birth? And sometimes it's just feeling in the inner world and the outer world and the world that is not too, just the beauty of arising, just the beauty of coming into being. And in this koan, Yunmen leaves us with a question: where do they come from? It's a beautiful question. It's a big question, very big, and not really answerable, you know, at least not in any ordinary way. But in the sequence of this koan, mountains, rivers, and the great earth, where do they come from? It leaves me with a feeling of awe, you know? Wow. Where does all of this beauty come from? I don't know. I don't know, but I love wherever that is, you know. I love it. I'm in awe of it. I bow down to it. I partake of it. You know. And as I was thinking of this koan, you know, another, I thought of our greatest poet of the great mother dragon, the born dragon. Again, I'm going to piggyback on Tenny and quote a little bit from Walt Whitman, from Song of Myself. I too am not a bit tamed. I too am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world. The last scud of day holds back for me. It flings my likeness after the rest, and true as any on the shadowed walls. It coaxes me into the vapor and the dust. I depart as air. I shake my white locks in the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot, souls. So, in our retreat, dragons and snakes are mingled. And we're riding all of these energies. It's not necessarily sequential. It's not a one and done. You know, we're just riding these currents. And we feel the movement. we feel the kinesthetic quality, the energetic movements from heart dragon bearing witness, feeling to a shedding snake, letting go, perhaps with pain and struggle, or perhaps just like flinging aside an old jacket that doesn't fit anymore. Sometimes there are moments of great death when we're just bitten by the snake and everything falls away. And new things start to sprout. You know, sometimes it's a long incubation period. Sometimes things just rise up right in front of us and make us laugh. There are so many tempos, moods, and depths to these snake dragon practices. So why is this important? You know, why is what we're doing here with these practices of dragon riding important? I'm going to share a few of my thoughts, and I'm really actually interested in yours too. So let me know what you think. So on just a personal level, as a human being, these practices help us develop a burnished and open heart to learn to be kind to ourselves, to really learn to be curious about all that happens, and then it kind of naturally leads to compassion for other suffering beings, you know, because we're all in it together. And when we have that container, you know, that sturdiness, that we can tolerate this, we can do it, we can bear it, we don't run away, then that allows us to show up in our lives in a really different way. We can show up for other people. We can show up for difficult situations. We can show up for challenges. We can roll with change without freaking out so much. And it's really the work of emotional maturity to not turn away. And it's also, I think, really important as a collective. We are in a time of incredible change, unprecedented change. Those things that are coming at us are just coming at such a rate. You know, it is a really interesting time to be here, and it's easy to get overwhelmed, to just give up. And so we really, the world needs people who can flexibly adapt, who know how to ride dragons. The anthropologist Margaret Mead talked about evolutionary clusters, that there are groups of people who become like a hub for change, for evolution. And that even though they're small in number, that if they can sort of gather in the right way, that they can be hubs for collective change in a larger way. And I have some hope that we here in this room could be an evolutionary cluster in our dragon training. And so when we cultivate a dragon heart, you know, we bring this to our frantic, noisy, and hyperactive world, that really needs it. Really needs it. And that kind of wise dragon, that containing dragon, can take a long view of time and know that we don't know what's going to happen, but that we can show up for the change. We can hold it. We have a capacity of heart-mind and a group of other people who are interested in cultivating those qualities of heart-mind. We can become a microcosm of that ability to shed what no longer serves, to incubate what's coming next, and to transform as needed, you know, into new versions, further evolutions. And the world needs us. I'm gonna leave us with a poem. Dragon Mother poem, I think. William Wordsworth, "I wandered lonely as a cloud. For oft, when on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, there flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils." Thank you. I welcome your musings, your questions, your reflections.
I was thinking at the end when you're saying, you know, the world needs us, and sometimes the Zen practice, it's felt good to work on myself. Because, you know, sometimes in the past, maybe thinking I was helping, I've harmed, or how good do I have to get at riding the dragon before maybe going out and helping? Or mm-hmm.
Maybe riding the dragon is helping. Mm-hmm.
Maybe you already help.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
Down in the gully.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's really inspiring to even think of the possibility of being an evolutionary cluster, and that here we are, you know, sitting doing nothing, but really facing it is so important, to be able to ride all the way through, you know, our grief and anger and, you know, all of it, the fears and guilt and so on. So I hadn't made that connection. I mean, it's great to be reminded to move from, you know, my individual struggle to just pay attention and let go of things.
Right.
But we're doing it together. Like at the beginning, we said, here we are alone together. Mm-hmm. But you bumped it up to this evolutionary cluster. I remember how struck I was by her talking about, me talking about how very small groups of people can work really hard to show something very kind of bright, I guess. And in a way, that's like dragon-like. It's a quiet dragon at first, and then it starts shining this light. And I thought, you know, this ancient, it's really striking to think of the ancient nature of this tradition.
Yeah.
And yet to see us here in the current moment in the world the way it is now, and even mentioning the possibility of that light radiating, as we often say about letting the love radiate.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's lovely imagery, but it from everything you said, it felt a little more real, a little more possible,
mm-hmm.
and a little more hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we become dragon riders, dragons ourselves, you know, not only for our benefit, right?
Yeah.
You know, we can feel the circle widen to our friends and families and communities. And I think it's really important and helpful to have that wise dragon perspective, the larger view, that what we're doing here matters, not just for ourselves, not just for each other, but the world needs this capacity.
Yes.
Very much. And we're doing it, you know, for all beings. Yeah, John.
I felt such energy as you spoke. I'm still feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
Touching on the pregnancy. And the dragon, and the, again, I'm rather at a loss for words. You chose them so well, including those beautiful poems. But just the energy and the strength, and it hopefully energized me as has this week. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joy. Yeah.
All of you.
Yeah.
You dragon riders, you.
Takes one to know one.
Giddy up.
Yes, Asa.
I just want to share a story about, this was a long time ago, and I was scheduled to go to session, and things kept happening in the house. Like, we had a leak in the basement, and people, you know, we were just like, ah! I said, okay, I can't go. And my daughter says, no, you have to go. Somebody has to bring back Sish in head.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Did you have something else, Joy?
I just wanted to interject something. I love snakes.
Uh-huh.
I love the danger, and I have the, they hang around, and I wonder what to do with them. And mainly just, you know, just leave them alone. I speak in favor of snakes, and I like that you brought that up. Thank you.
Yeah, Frank.
So I find that my practice I'm surprised by myself often. And one of the things that's surprising me, particularly today, is really diving into the metaphysical language and symbolism of what we're talking about. And I just wonder if you could say something about, and including maybe borrowing some from our Tibetan cousins, particularly of warriorhood,
mm-hmm.
which I think is,
mm-hmm.
that warrior energy is right in there with,
yeah.
dragons.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'd love to hear more about metaphysically and symbolic language of what we're doing.
You know, I think I understand the warrior metaphor, and I've never cared for it. I don't like the war imagery, you know? And it's one of the reasons why I love the mother dragon, is that she's got a vital energy, but it's coming from a different place. We don't have to be at war. We don't have to fight. You know? We can move with the Tao. We can find our way into the energy of what is skillfully. We can align ourselves. We can give rise to what's needed. And so I think that our words and symbols matter. And I, for one, am just all done with the war stuff. Yeah.
Thanks.
Tenny?
So you have the couple names for this, but there's the container dragon, and then there's the writhing around dragon that's kind of contained, you know?
Yeah.
So you evoked a little bit about the container dragon in relation to practice, just in terms of the space of a retreat or something like that. But could you say some more about the way in which in practice over maybe, I don't know, a few months or a few years, maybe we're able to, you know, how does this happen? We kind of develop more trust that there is this kind of container dragon that can hold it. And some of that is psychological work for sure, but some of it also seems to be practice work that isn't exactly psychological. So I wonder if you could talk a little more about that.
Yeah. Well, maybe you could talk a little bit about it.
I want you to talk about it.
Can you say something?
In a way, I guess what I would say is it was partly very tentative trial and error.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if I can do this. I think I can do it.
Yeah.
And it turned out I could do it.
Yeah.
I think also, yeah, really, it was the context of retreat.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, it was the context of Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
And in some weird way, I've been talking to a couple of people during this retreat about the really beautiful sutra service.
Yeah.
And this, you know, probably was getting to know people a little bit better, so they, you know, weren't only faces in retreat. But that, the sense of sort of warmth and sweetness and a kind of strength. And I mean, there was a kind of an emotional and spiritual quality to...
Yeah.
To that dragon, you know, the
Absolutely.
Sutra service. It's so beautiful, this retreat so far.
Right.
And then I feel also, for me, having a teacher that I gradually trusted. And so that's, you know, people say that the teacher can sort of hold the place of your awakening when you can't see it. But I think in a way they're sort of helping, you know, they're like a backup container dragon in a way. That would be... my experience of
it. No, I remember literally one time like falling into Joan's arms and she having to catch me. So yeah, sometimes just almost like a literal containment. And I love what you're saying, the beautiful, robust container of the tradition, you know, that, you know, we're not just making this up. You know, this is time tested. The sutra service is, you know, it's ancient wisdom. It's been... people have been living into this forever. You know, it's old. I mean, we have the history that we have, but it goes so much further back, you know. Those shamanic parts that Sarah was talking about. You know, that's a robust container. The Sangha, you know, the way that we're doing it together. The incredible, incredibly beautiful, strong and flexible container of this retreat, of any retreat, where it's so well thought, it's so easy, it looks effortless, you know? And it is that, the incubator, right, of lots of baby dragons.
Mm-hmm.
Martha?
Yeah, I'm kind of hearing something about vow and the not to of the snakes and dragons. Actually, when it was probably when I was writing vows, I had this dream about the green snake, and kind of what Casey was saying, there was a feeling of responsibility that this was something dangerous that I needed to work with containing, actually, and I had it in a box, the green snake, and I drilled a hole in the bottom of the box so that the snake could get And then the snake was like dragon energy. It was just like I was in the city street, and it was just whipping through the New York City. And I don't know. There's something about that personal work. I think that that's how we are the dragon energy. That's how I don't know who embody the that mother energy that you mentioned.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you. We just have a few minutes, so maybe two or three more. Let's see. Estrella?
Yeah, I love how you brought the snakes in. The snakes are so much of the earth because they you know, they're touching, every part of them is touching the earth. And the danger of them is the danger of the earth. I mean, the earth can kill us all. You know, a big wind can come along, a big flood can come along, you know. We are really dependent on respecting the earth the way people used to be able to live here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, I think the snakes and the dragons are more relations than they are in any way opposed to each other.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, they're both, and there are relations.
Yeah, beautiful. John.
Yeah, I was just going to say something like that. The thing that struck me the most about this retreat, one, it's my first retreat, but what struck me was the imagery of the dragon. I never really considered the dragon anything but, you know, a hostile creature, right? Like what we're talking about snakes being. And over the course of the last few days, it's like, well, you know, dragons and snakes are very closely intertwined, right? They kind of look the same in some ways, and dragons are transformational. So I'm still, you know, sort of coming up with that, and I love that statement about the snake being grounded, you know, and the dragon is everywhere. So I have to really rethink everything about that. But I kind of think they're one and the same, and we just have to differentiate them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one little comment I want to make about where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at those petroglyphs, you see dragons, you see people in community, right? You see that
right.
Wisdom.
Yeah.
That predates probably this culture, or this, you know, it goes back before written time, before recorded time. You know, we're just sort of, we've been building on it for probably tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah.
And they just left us a little glimpse of what they had.
Mm.
Maybe they did something just like this.
Probably, and you know, one thing we were noticing is that the archaeologists estimate that these petroglyphs were probably made between about 800 and 1100 of the current era, which is exactly the time that the koans were developed. So something, you know, something's brewing.
Came out of dragon.
Yeah. Yeah, dragons were born.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Gensho, sorry.
Oh, yeah, sorry, Gensho.
I don't want to be a conversation killer.
That's Frank's job.
You don't like the word warrior.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem with the word container.
Okay.
Containment to me sounds like a prison.
Uh-huh.
And I know you don't mean that. Mm-mm. Can you think of another word?
Lockbox.
That's prison.
Solitary confinement.
Make it a womb?
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
Did you say a womb?
Womb.
Yes.
Can I just say one more thing?
Sure.
Because I've been thinking this whole time that I could possibly make a bridge between, you know, warrior mentality and mother energy.
Yeah.
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 Because, you know, I've
you met my mother.
No, but she is one.
I practiced for a long time in a very warrior community, you know. And, but what it really is, and what when I finally, when you give birth, you're there and you can't get out of it, you know. You get more pain than you ever thought you could imagine. And you just keep, I can't do this, I can do this, I can't do this, I can do it. And you just somehow do it. And, right, all the moms?
It's a little like sitting still after you've gone through a patch of poison ivy.
Yeah. Yeah, I did that too.
But I love that womb.
Yeah,
you know, that feeling. That's the original container, right, for all of us.
Yeah.
Right? And
there's only...
And everything is provided, right? All our needs are met. We're just,
it's possible.
It's like being in a spa, you know? But then we start to outgrow it.
Right, and you're not going to be there forever.
No, you're not going to be there forever. It's an incubator, right?
And the dragon flies.
Yeah, and you can't stay. Thank you, everybody.